Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
I'm John Golia.
And I'm Greg Fife. And we are
the Flight Safety Detectives.
We're just two guys who have spent most of their career with the National Transportation Safety Board investigating aircraft disasters and aviation safety issues all over the world.
Yep, and this podcast is where we talk about everything from accidents, airplane technology, to the big business of aviation.
We live and breathe aviation. My co-host, John, has been in the aviation business for more than 60 years. He was the first and only airframe and power plant mechanic to get a presidential appointment to the National Transportation Safety Board.
And Greg is a former air safety investigator and GO team captain for the NTSB. He's investigated everything that flies worldwide since he started his career 40 years ago. And on top of that, he is a living Legends of Aviation inductee.
So between John and myself, we have over 100 years of aviation safety experience. It's time to buckle up because it's going to be wheels up. Let's get this show in the air.
Well, hello, my friend. It's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I know you are back in the Boston area, John, while I'm out here in Colorado basking in sunlight and blue skies after having a little bit of a snowstorm and shoveling 2 tons of snow. I know that you're just enjoying the fact that I had to go out there and shovel all that snow.
I am tickled pink.
Yeah, I knew you would be. The good thing is it's going to be 60 degrees and all gone by the weekend, so I can't complain a whole lot. This is just to humble us a little bit.
Keep your feet on the ground, so to speak.
Exactly. So it's always a great pleasure every week for us to be able to do this podcast. And we really appreciate that fact. And also the fact that the show is sponsored by PAMA and Avemco Insurance.
Yes. And for all our listeners, if you have an airplane and you're about to renew your insurance, or if you're going to buy an airplane and you need to get insurance, or if you're a flight instructor or a renter, renters need insurance today often, a requirement by some of the companies that you rent from, give Avemco a call at 888-879-0389. And if you tell them you've been listening to the Flight Safety Detectives, they give you a 5% discount. You know, they insure Greg, and if they insure Greg, they're ready to take on the world.
That's right. Absolutely, man. I'm their biggest safety risk. So, but it's always good because every week you and I have had so many discussions leading up to the show and when we record it that, you know, I get excited about the fact that not only do we have great subjects to talk about, but we also bring on great people who are subject matter experts. One of the concerns I have, of course, over this past week was a tragic general aviation accident down in Pembroke Pines, Florida. It was a Beach Bonanza, turbocharged Beach Bonanza, that apparently had been imported from South Africa in pieces. The two guys that were on board the aircraft apparently owned, and this is all early information, but these two guys apparently owned some sort of aircraft brokerage. They supposedly reassembled this airplane, painted it up nice and pretty. It was a low-time airplane, very low-time, which I find very hard to believe. But again, I haven't seen any of the records. But when you have a 1997 vintage airplane with only 357 hours or thereabouts total time, you got to start questioning things. But apparently they had had numerous problems. They were troubleshooting them. And on this particular takeoff, that airport, and John, you're familiar with that airport because you spend a lot of time down in Florida. In fact, you were just out there, I think, very recently. But for folks that know that airport down there, North Perry, I believe it's what it's called, it's got a short runway. And that airport is surrounded by houses and offices and things like that. So there's not a lot of margin of error and margin of safety when it comes to putting the aircraft down in places, especially after you lose an engine right at takeoff like these folks did. And the proverbial 180-degree turn back to the runway, which the FAA has coined the impossible turn. We've been talking about this particular maneuver for years and trying to educate pilots. This was a classic case where it looks like they tried to come back around, except being at very low altitude and low airspeed, not a lot of margin there. They ended up stalling the airplane. And unfortunately, this tragic accident was caught on a Ring doorbell video. So you actually watch the sequence of as the aircraft strikes the ground, and it actually struck a passing SUV. Unfortunately, a four-year-old boy was killed in the SUV, of course, with the two occupants of the airplane. And as a flight instructor, you know, you start talking about the impossible turn. And there are pros and cons. The FAA has talked about the impossible turn over the years. I know that a good friend of ours, Brian Schiff and Barry Schiff, have talked about the fact that you can do the impossible turn safely. You have to have skills. You have to have at least some demonstrated practice. You can't just go out there and expect to be able to do it. And so there's a lot of pros and cons. And I think that it's going to be, I know that we've had Brian on our show, and it may be time to get him back on to talk about all of the stuff that he did with the impossible turn. And he has a 172 that he uses. You always preach it at the end of the shows about pre-flights and that kind of stuff. Part of that pre-flight, and I think about it, I plan for it when I take off, is if something happens below 500 feet, where am I putting this airplane down? And while I have, you know, several home airports, if you will, I know what's at the end of each of these airports. I know which direction I have to go if something happens taking off on the various runways. Pilots need to make sure that they have plan A and plan B when they're taking off, whether it's from their home airport or from, of course, a unfamiliar airport. You got to look at, pull up Google Earth. If you don't know the area, pull up Google Earth, get an idea of what the terrain, what the environment is around these airports. Because if you lose the engine at 200 feet, you're not turning around. You're going to have to go straight ahead, and you're going to have to find the best place. It's just sad because when you and I see these types of accidents like we've seen over the years, and where you have an innocent, in this case, an innocent bystander, that is a mother and her four-year-old child in a car who unknowingly, unsuspecting, gets whacked by an airplane coming out of the sky, it's very tragic. The loss of life and, of course, the trauma that it causes in the neighborhoods, it's very sad. So we're going to be talking more about the impossible turn, if you will, and what pilots and airports can do to help mitigate this.
Good morning, you're on the ground, Canadian 920. We're just coming up to Alpha Juliet.
So, folks, we have Sandy Murdoch with us today, who in his prior lives was the chief counsel of the FAA. He was also an acting deputy administrator of the FAA, and he has also worked for numerous law firms before and after his time with the FAA. So welcome, Sandy.
Good morning, or afternoon, excuse me.
Well, it all depends. It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not 5 o'clock here in Colorado, Sandy. So, but Sandy, one of the things that we had talked about with a previous guest, John Allen, who you know very well, we got into a variety of subjects regarding the FAA, but we really didn't dig into their issues with what has transpired since the 737 MAX events took place, and of course, all of the fallout from that. And then after a couple of years of consternation and, of course, getting beat up by not only our congressional members, but now basically other organizations, certifying organizations around the world, there is a loss of confidence in the FAA. And I think the first question I want to ask you is, you got Steve Dixon, who's the administrator. We now have a new administration with President Biden, and he brought on a political appointee, Brad Mims, who is a veteran with regard to the FAA. So I know you're going to have to break this down and unpackage it, but where do you see the FAA going, and what are they going to have to do to regain that stature worldwide, given the fact that there is a significant loss of confidence in their ability from the fallout of the 737 MAX?
Well, thanks for having me. I had to crank up my chair a couple of levels to feel like I could see you guys eye to eye as we talk. It's very, very tough. And I think it's stick to basics, get down to doing what they do well and concentrate on that. I think the best way to work the way out of it is just to get the next series of major decisions absolutely right. And I think that's something that I hope Captain Dixon can do. But there are some things that I think should be done on a less direct way that can help rebuild, as John has called a couple of papers, the gold standard that has been recognized around the world. First and foremost, we got to recognize that EASA, the European Aviation Safety Administration, is in a positive, aggressive mode of trying to build strong relations with countries with whom we've had great relationships for years and years and years. They even have an initiative involving Latin America, and we have to recognize that and deal with it affirmatively, not, you know, kick sand or anything, but just recognize that we have somebody out there who's trying to convince them that their way of certificating is better than the FAA's. And that has all kinds of subsidiary impact. The second thing that I think we really need to know is that the word promote was in the statute. And now Chairman DeFazio, several years ago, got it removed. And it's superficially an easy thing to do, but it wasn't intended to be promote like sell Boeing. It was promote as in sell FAA and the American high standard of aviation stuff. So those are two subtle but immediate things that need to be mindful of. They're not necessarily, you know, have big poster boards walking around saying FAA is better than the EASA, just doing the work. And we need to recognize that the work is technical, people. And over 30 years, 40 years that I've been watching the FAA, the people who have been stationed around the world were knowledgeable, energetic FAA employees, people who really wanted to do their job well. The level of people who are in the international offices, FAA people who are overseas, is very small. As best I can tell, there's somebody in Singapore and somebody in Brussels. It's hard to tell because the FAA doesn't publish telephone books anymore, but I think there's one of those in each. And the person in Singapore is a former political appointee, so I don't know. A fellow named Vishal Amin has been recently named to go to India. And that's good because he is of that background. He's an Indian by birth, and I think an Air Force Academy graduate, and I think somebody John knows, but the COVID thing has stopped him from doing it.
Sure.
You know, Sandy, they've reduced those offices to one person. I visited Singapore and Europe multiple times on NTSB business, and there was always a team of people there in Singapore. And in India, I've been to India, in Europe, you know, we had an FAA person in London, in Paris, in Rome. I've met with all of them while I was over there. So it was more than just a person, but they've pulled back, probably because of budget concerns, they've pulled back all those people. I mean, we had maintainer, I've known several of them that were over either maintenance or certification. Beth Erickson was one. Jay Hiles was over in Singapore, and they brought their expertise. And
Steve Wallace in Rome.
Right, Steve Wallace in Rome.
But yes, those people are gone, and they now are listed on the FAA International as there's being somebody called care of FAA at an embassy. And I think those are some sort of Department of State people who really aren't necessarily knowledgeable about the issues. And that's really what was happening there. You know, Steve Wallace would talk to people and tell them what he knew about, you know, the kinds of things that John and Greg do every day. I mean, he was technically very, very competent.
Yeah.
I think he's building his own airplane at the moment. That's not there anymore. And that's horrible. And the hope, some ways, is for me, is that Lawrence Wildgood, who was recently appointed to the Assistant Administrator for Policy, International Affairs, and Environment, who is a veteran of the Senate Aviation Committee and worked for Senator Cantwell. He knows about the state of Washington, and I think he probably knows about the fact that Washington's probably the least favorite employer, but largest employer, needs the support of the FAA overseas in an educational, not a sales mode. So that's some degree of hope, for me at least.
Sandy, you brought something up a little earlier, and that was, you know, when you start looking at the FAA and you look at the relationship between the FAA and a big organization like EASA, and then, of course, the other certifying authorities, of course, one of the criticisms that came out of the 737 MAX issues and the House testimony was the fact that everybody has characterized this, quote, love-in between the FAA and Boeing. The ODA program came under fire, but people really don't understand the ODA program. And if I remember right, you wrote some sort of article recently or in the recent past about the ODA program. Could you just give our listeners, John and I have talked about it, but it's good to get a different voice, especially your perspective. Can you just give us the Reader's Digest version of this ODA program and the importance and really the criticality of having a program like this, not only between the FAA and Boeing, but the FAA and other manufacturers? And again, this type of program does exist outside the United States with the EASA and their manufacturers, does it not?
Yes, it exists pretty much every major certificating organization around the world that has the volume of work that the United States and the European countries have. The reason why we have a problem comes from a fairly basic fact. If I'm the head of engineering at Boeing, and it's time for me to go hire some new engineers, they go to MIT and Caltech and all kinds of the most famous aeronautical engineering organizations, and the line for their jobs is very, very long. And it's not just because it's Boeing, it's because they're going to make more money in the immediate term and in the long term. And there's a big career path, and it's someplace that engineering is the essence of being. They've had CEOs who were engineers. Last one really wasn't that good of one, but they've had CEOs who are engineers. The same thing happens when the FAA sends people out, and they don't get the people from MIT and Caltech, and they certainly don't have the depth of people. If you look at the engineering organization out in Renton, the Boeing people who are involved in engineering probably can fill the baseball stadium, and the FAA people can't fill the dugout. And that's a fact of life. That's Congress is never going to appropriate enough funds to have that to be an equal balance of talent and depth of talent. And it's not just talent, it's depth of talent. And so out of that grew the fact for designation. And that's something the FAA does almost in every one of its testing functions. They're designated pilot examiners, designated medical examiners, on and on and on. And the DOA is something that was critical. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have airplanes coming out. Now, is as presently constituted DOA what it should ought to be? No, it's not. And frankly, I think this is my own view, not the views of my employers or any of my former employers. Part of the problem is that imbalance still is somewhat there. And the people who deal at the margin of those conversations are aware of the fact that some of the requests by the FAA of the certificating entity, whatever it is, sometimes doesn't really match the refined, defined needs of the analysis. That becomes annoying, and that's the reason why we have a DOA. The DOA relationship at Boeing, as evidenced by all of those emails that were disclosed, was not one of high regard by the applicant and the certificator.
So with that being said, when you talk about the fact of an imbalance and the FAA not getting the cream of the crop, if you will, because one, they can't be competitive in a salary such as with a Boeing or even one of the general aviation manufacturers. But two, out of the House hearings, everybody started making this case. Well, why doesn't the FAA just bring this in-house instead of having the designated program? Well, somebody brought up the numbers and said, well, you're going to have to hire 10,000 engineers and you're going to have to increase the FAA's budget $1 billion. And that's where they left it. And of course, you know, there's been some banter in the media about, well, let's do it. What are you waiting for? Well, we all know in reality that will never happen. So what's the at least a solution? Do we need to bring more of that authority in-house, or do we have to have a tighter rein on the designees?
Well, I think Congress actually did something right, which is unusual for me to say, in giving the FAA some more money. Whether that's going to carry them far enough to maintain the pace that is required in the global and competitive environment, and that's true in Brazil and Japan and every place else. This is a first, the market frequently has an impact, but you still have to have the high level of assurance. And I've written about this before, so my employer, Joe DiBozzo, can't yell at me yet. You know, before 1938, before there was a CAA, if you bought your nice little airplane and wanted to go fly it, and you called up your insurance agent and said, want to buy me some insurance, and maybe Avemco could do that now, and they said, well, how do I know it's safe? What they did then was a company called Underwriters Laboratories in Illinois sent their engineers and looked at it, and you paid them a fee, and they said, it's airworthy. We now do that with the government. I am not 100% convinced that that wouldn't be a good idea. It's going to be some transition problems. You can't just sort of take all the people who have been doing this work for 25 years and throw them away. And most importantly, you're going to have to charge somebody for the services. And I see absolutely no reason why that shouldn't be the company that's seeking the certificate. If you were to sit outside of 800 Independence Avenue and watch things walk in and things walk out, the people with the greatest value increase from that visit are the holders of Part 21, Part 23, Part 25, and on certificates. Before they went in there, the certificate was worth nothing. And when it comes out, it's a very valuable asset. Seems to me there's a good economic justification for doing that. The pricing of it and what you get to buy out of it are something that need to be worked out, but that's why we have Congress. It's a very radical idea, it's shocking and all sorts of stuff, but I'm a history buff and I found that fact some time ago and find it very fascinating and compelling. But short of that, I think we just need to stick to what we do best and get to work on it.
In your description, it had the overtones of privatization. and we continually throw that word around, you know, taking services and requirements and of course,
the key part of my thing is they would do the testing. The FAA would do the standards. So when you got your medical examination, that was privatized. You paid that guy for your certificate, right? I don't think it's that absurd. I think it's going to be an interesting pricing question. And frankly, I love to throw it out, but I know too well how Congress will respond to anything that is logical, rational, and scary.
Yeah, John and I have had that discussion as well, because, you know, a lot of their stuff is more emotional than factual or logical. And we've kind of questioned that over the past year on the show. So I appreciate your perspective on all of that.
Sandy, I want to go back a minute ago to what you said, or several minutes ago, about EASA. You know, before I went to the NTSB, I served on a number of harmonization committees. And we worked hand in glove with the European authorities, starting with the JAA, and about lining our rules up. And I sat through those meetings when the FAA representative promised we were going to do certain things. And the one that always crushed me was Part 66 of the FARs. It was a modernization of Part 65. And I can remember Fred Leonelli and I forget the name of the attorney that was assigned to that group. We assured the Europeans over and over and over that we were going to implement all those changes. And it wasn't just 65. It was a considerable adjustment to the U.S. regulations to line them up with where the Europeans wanted to be. So it was a negotiated piece and an update for the U.S. So I left the committee and came back, and that work continued. And essentially, the FAA reneged on all the promises they made. We did not adopt all of the rules that we did. The Europeans did, because they had a clean sheet of paper. They weren't replacing any rules, really. They were just starting to implement, and they put them in place. And I always believed that that was part of the reason why the Europeans have been so successful in getting, and I don't even know what the current count is, but it was, it may have actually been in triple digits now, countries around the world to sign on to the EASA rules and not the FAA rules. And, you know, something's got to be done with the system, that when you decide to go in and make a change to a rule, that you're going to be between 10 years and 20 years before you get that rule implemented. I mean, we've wanted to rewrite the repair station rule, and it's been going on since the 90s.
Yeah, it's...
You know, how do we get the FAA to do their job to move these issues? The answer, or the excuse, has always been, we don't have the money. You know, and many of the improvements that come out of their rulemaking advisory committees make it to a list, and the list may be 3 pages long, and they never have enough resources to go past the first page. And, something's got to be done.
That's not new. When I was there, Walt Lufsey had a list of things, and as chief counsel, I attended their quarterly review of where we were on the list. And it's listed in order, not of length of time it's been there, but what they regarded it as the safety risk. And I assume with SMS, that's even more precise now. One of the problems is that every bill that we get, reauthorization bill, has 800 sections. About 600 of them are study this, do that, and they're all within 90 days of completion of this enactment of the statute. I exaggerate a bit, but there is the list of things the FAA has to do has that to it. It's always inserted, and the Congressional Affairs Office calls up Ali Bahrami and said, number 7 on the list needs to get done next Tuesday, or the congressman is going to go nuts. Perfect example is the seat standards and the evacuation standards, which have been due for the last 6 months. and that's a year after the statutory deadline. I don't know how we fix that. I do know that, well, I have suggested that if I'm Congressman X and I'm now going to establish the requirement that the tire plies of all airplanes be assessed as a safety hazard, and maybe that's an issue. But before, in my legislation requiring that, I would have to take the FAA list and say it goes number six here in front of the decision about foreign repair stations. That's what we have to do. I mean, you can't, and, you know, with SMS, there's a way to quantify all that and make it fairly rational, because we just, there are lots and lots of things that are on that list that are just absurd. And they don't necessarily go in the order of their importance. They go in the order of the members' rank on the committee. I mean, it used to be ridiculous that, you know, I would get a call from Congressional Affairs Office. I was one of those horrible Reagan Republicans, and said that Congressman so-and-so wants this by next week. And I said, is he a Republican or a Democrat? Those days, we took care of the Republicans first. That's the reality of it all. Is the process capable of reform? Yes. If you look at a flow chart of an NPRM process from day one to its enactment.
Let me just stop you, Sandy, because I want to make sure that our listeners understand some of these acronyms and,
I'm sorry.
And FARs. No, that's okay. The NPRM is a notice of proposed rulemaking. That is part of really the regulatory process. So you're drafting this regulation, it goes out for comment, comments are returned, and then of course they're reviewed, and it could go back out for multiple comments, or based on that, the FAA takes those comments, incorporates it into their ideology or philosophy in the regulation. Okay, back to you.
That's a good primer on it, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Sure.
But the process starts off with somebody, usually within the aviation safety office, coming up with a good idea. And it's assigned to somebody in an organization, typically somebody who has some experience in that area, and he or she writes a draft rule. That's not easy, and it's a draft rule that has to be what? Enforceable. It can't just say do good. Regulations by necessity have to be measurable. And so that gets to be that's not an easy thing to do on your first blush. So what happens with it then? It gets kicked over to the chief counsel's office, and the chief counsel people put in those words that make it enforceable. Then it goes through a process that is required by the Office of Management and Budget. And that is, you have to go figure out what the economic impact, what the impact on small businesses, what the impact of the environment, blah, 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 on and on and on. So then you get a package that's put together. It goes at a very high level of approval within the FAA, chief counsel, head of flight standards, head of policy, the administrator, the deputy administrator. That takes time. When that's done, it's tied up in a bow and sent across the street to the office of the secretary, where typically some of the political hacks like me are there to go say, no, we're not going to do this. Or, you know, this semicolon should be a colon, shouldn't it? So when that gets kicked back to the FAA again, and they go through and work on all that stuff out. And sometimes some of the comments are very substantive. Some of the political perspectives are valid, and the economic impact really wasn't adequately assessed, as an example. So then that all gets through. The secretary says, fine and dandy, and it goes over to the Office of Management and Budget. And I can remember, like it was yesterday, I took a particular rule that Administrator Helms had wanted to get through, and I went over to meet with the OMB officer who was in charge of the rule review, and the person was very young, had graduated from college and her master's degree in less than 6 years, and knew everything. It was very clear. And she said, you know, and I said, no, I don't. And by the way, my boss, who helped write this rule, was involved in exactly what you're talking about and knows the inner workings and all. She says, I don't give a damn. So we had to go back and write it so she was happy. And then you go to the NPRM. Then it goes out for comments. And every one of the comments has to be read. And then you finally go through that same process, not in the same level of detail, but again, before it goes out as a final rule. And then you run the risk of an appeal to court. It's easy to say it's just those civil servants who are just taking the good, easy time. It's not. That's not so. There is some of that. But it is a burdensome process. And EASA doesn't have that same level of burden, at least I don't see. And by the way, if you spend much time trying to read their documents, I know they're writing for four languages, but it tests my capabilities to vet the words. I'm not sure they're better.
Yeah, sometimes I can't follow their logic, and it may be just something lost in the interpretation or whatever. But it is tough. And I know that, you know, that is one thing that not only those of us in the industry, the aviation industry, but really in the general population, these are the kinds of things that a lot of people don't understand. You know, they always ask, well, why does it take so long? I mean, it's obvious that you need to do something. The FAA needs to do something to enhance safety. But that is the process. Now the question is there a way, given the fact that when there is a serious situation, we saw that recently with the engine issue out here in Colorado on a United 777. And that is, they put out an emergency AD. They want all these engines inspected and everything else. Well, if that can be done with a stroke of a pen, basically overnight, why can't we streamline the process to improve aviation safety with these critical issues? Why do we have to go through this burdensome process? That's part one. Part two is there a way for something to occur to be the 30 micron filter so we filter out the politics and we are able to prioritize those safety of flight issues as they should be prioritized and not based on the guy who may be sitting on the appropriations committee and threatening that you don't do this, you don't get money.
Well, if we could remove OMB, I think it would speed up the process. The only thing I could think of is greater involvement earlier by the reviewing. Some of these issues, I remember we had a very high level meeting within the FAA and a process that we're talking about automated weather observation stations. And God knows how many hundreds of hours have been contributed to figuring out how to do this right. And the idea was that you'd be flying and you could dial into this information source and find out what the weather is. And AWAS would tell you exactly what the weather was at that time, at that place. And Tony Broderick said, I'm not a pilot, but I suspect I don't necessarily care about what the weather is right now at that time. I want to know what it is when I'm supposed to land. And so all the people had to go back and do their work. If Tony had had the chance to look at it earlier, maybe we'd save some time. And I think that's the same thing here, that some of the inputs. So many of the political people in OM, in the secretary's office, are uncomfortable meeting directly with the career civil servants. They find that their statement of political objectives can be more robust, clearer, whatever, when they're talking to fellow political hacks. It was interesting. Drew Lewis, when I was there, would have meetings in his office. He would invite who would come. So, example, I went to a meeting one time and sat down at the table and saw my deputy across the table. Drew was not afraid to tell people what he thought were legitimate concerns. And more importantly, he wanted the people who were there to give him his advice. It takes a lot of comfort with your masculinity, I think it's the way William Raspberry put it about Ronald Reagan. It takes a lot of that. I'm not sure every secretary has that.
Yeah.
Unless we start integrating those views earlier or removing the need for those views, and the choice between those two is integrate, it's going to take time. And it doesn't necessarily contribute to the quality of the rulemaking. I can't tell you how many times I looked at a document that came out of flight standards, and I knew the person who'd written it and asked him or her to come see me. And I said, this is not as clear as you're capable of writing. And the draft person said, you're right. I did that intentionally because I knew those jerks across the street were going to make me do it over again. So I didn't bother to make it perfect.
Yeah, that's a sad testament. We have been talking about big airplanes, airlines, and manufacturers like Boeing and the certification. What's your take on general aviation these days? We see, of course, not only the fact that whether it's because of the pandemic or just general aviation as a whole, the manufacturing of certificated aircraft has, you know, it varies. It goes up, it goes down. And we have the established manufacturers. We've seen, of course, a lot more home-built aircraft and experimental aircraft. And of course, one of my biggest concerns was the sports pilot certificate for a variety of different reasons. And of course, that means with the sports certificate, the pilots weren't required to meet all the standards as that of a private pilot or whatever. And now the FAA wants to, or is in the process of allowing folks that fly with under basic med to fly larger aircraft and fly more people in those aircraft. And with all of the health concerns these days, especially now with COVID, but, you know, some of the underlying conditions that we've seen in our society, just give me your take on general aviation as a whole from a global perspective.
Well, general aviation is a very loose term these days. If you look at the business aviation, COVID has taken a lot of executives and said, getting on the airplane with these other people ain't a good thing to do, so I'm going to justify getting my G3 out and flying around a little bit more. The other aspect of it, from a manufacturing standpoint, the new prescriptive regulations, performance regulations as opposed to prescriptive regulations, has stimulated the heck out of Part 23 applications. And the innovations that are there are amazing. Whether there's going to be demand after all of this economic impact, that's beyond my capabilities. But the thing I find amazing, looking back 10, 15 years ago, particularly when I left the FAA, I said, you know, deregulation has pumped up a lot of the airlines, but the industry in general, I think, is reaching a maturity where growth is going to slow down or come to a halt. But recently, with these unmanned vehicles and all the different dimensions, unpersoned vehicles, see, there's an initiative to make sure that man gets out of the regulation. That's exciting. Whether it has the outcome that is anticipated or not is not another thing. On the safety side, your friends out at Frederick have a lot more clout, and they are convinced that the marginal benefit health standards is not that great, and more than likely to sell some of those airplanes. And they've gotten pretty far along. The interesting thing is that the FAA has a new head of medicine. I wrote about her recently. I can't remember her name, but God gave me a computer. And she's very impressive. She's got the kind of credentials that you really, really want to see in the FAA.
Yeah, and that's Dr. Susan Northrup.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see how she deals with that. And frankly, the whole medical part of the FAA has not had a great recent history. You know, the Bad Albert rules and caused a lot of backlash, and there's a lot of negativity associated with the flight standard people, with the aviation medicine people. So I have some hope that that's going to get better. I also have to say that I'm impressed with the degree to which AOPA has done a good job at being more proactive in training particularly on weather issues and stuff like that. So I'm somewhat hopeful that that's for the upturn. I think even Europe seems to be coming a little more open to general aviation, which at one point in time that they were sort of like considered like fighter planes to be shot down. Yeah. But, you know, the EASA material on that is generally pretty positive and frequent. So I don't know. I'm not a good prognosticator there.
Let's switch then to one thing that, of course, is now evolving and really comes under the FAA purview and made some news recently with a very wealthy individual, Elon Musk, and the fact that he couldn't launch his rocket because the FAA had some safety concerns. What's your take now on commercial space and the FAA's responsibility with regard to commercial space? I know that Elon Musk lit up the FAA thinking that because of his money and his power, that they should be listening to him. What do you see in the immediate future, given the fact that we are moving at a very quick pace for commercial space and they're looking to hopefully have folks paying passengers, if you will, in space before the end of the year?
Well, let me make a couple of different observations. One, the whole aspect of entrepreneurs trying to deal with the FAA is a matter of some concern. When Amazon first came to bring the idea of drones flying their packages around and basically tried to browbeat the administrator, just didn't happen well. I mean, that's, you know, they're used to beating up on the Stillwell, Oklahoma building code men and getting their way with it. Doesn't happen with the FAA. That's number one. Number two, I really can't say anything about the competence of the FAA Space Transportation Certificating Organization. I don't know the people. I don't know the engineering, chemistry, whatever. So I really can't say anything about that. What I can say is that I am very worried that the FAA has a very important, difficult mission already, just with big, small, and medium. To add now drones that will become more populous than bees, I think, in the near future, and space really stretches their competence. There is no special, there's no particular continuity between space shots and what the FAA does, except for the air traffic. And that's something you could deal with differently. I don't see any particular reason why it had to be an FAA thing. It just doesn't seem to me that it fits naturally. And they have people with impressive names and titles and stuff like that. But I don't know how Steve Dixon can be working on the future of air traffic on international aviation issues and trying to figure out what the heck is going on with space. That's just my...
Do you think that NASA could have been at least either reorganized or a department added to NASA, since they are the experts in rocketry and space, and provide them with some authority to be the regulators of space and let them deal with it, since they have the personnel, the resources, and that kind of thing, and take that space away from the FAA, but have some sort of liaison or coordination with the FAA?
I mean, I suspect that's a good idea. I suspect it's something that the purists at NASA will say, over my dead body. We don't regulate. We just do the things we do and do them well. I would love to see our friends over at the Office of Secretary, who already are omniscient, to take this in and actually see them try to integrate space with the rest of transportation. That's their real job. It's not to be setting all the help they give to the FAA. Their real job is to be integrating these policies and what the need for space transportation and what ground infrastructure needs to support that and the safety areas for landing and all kind of stuff seems to me to be into the policy arena of the Office of Secretary of Transportation. I think they give them more to do. Means there's less bother to the FAA.
one of the things that I heard that was the rub with SpaceX was that whenever he shut down the airspace to do one of his tests, it impacted on Houston. And the airlines through the A4A have been complaining like crazy that because he shuts down a good block of airspace, that they have to take on extra fuel and they're spending an extra several minutes on average per flight to get in and out of that already congested airspace down there. It was really an airspace issue that was causing SpaceX all the grief. And it was partially themselves, because just this week again, they shut down a ground road that's near their facility for 5 days because they're going to launch one test rocket. But they've got a window of time of 5 days blocked out, which means air traffic has got to route airplanes around him for 5 days for the possibility of him having a test flight. So that's been the rub.
Maybe they could start launching in Fort Lauderdale.
There you go.
I think that's the main reason why he went and bought that oil rig.
Well, if he can launch from Fort Lauderdale, we know somebody will be upset.
Yeah, I think in a couple of years from now, he'll be launching into the water, into the Gulf, and be further away so we won't have that problem.
Travel pitch field. Nav exterior light. Servo control.
Sandy, you write a lot of articles that appear on JDA Aviation's website. And one of the things that I'm interested in, and you recently wrote about it, was wildlife. I worked a citation that landed in South Carolina, in Greenville, South Carolina. And during rollout, the aircraft hit a deer, split open the leading edge of the wing, started losing fuel. The airplane caught fire and burned up on the runway. And currently I'm working a couple of bird strike accidents, and these aren't just small birds. I got a 172 that flew through a pelican at pretty high altitude. You talked about it in your article about some of the mitigation. And I remember eons ago, because I did some research on it, that the DOT IG was critical of the FAA and their wildlife hazard mitigation program and that kind of stuff. And I found your article interesting. Of course, there's been a lot of work, but is it enough? And what needs to be done? I know that airports are of concern. As a kid, because I grew up in the DC area, I used to go out to Buzzard's Point right off the end of the runway at Washington Reagan. Yeah. And there were always birds out there for a variety of different reasons. Never thought anything of it until I got older and got into this business. And now I know exactly what the impact of those birds are on airplanes, especially in that segment of flight at Washington National. But do you see we are doing enough and the FAA is doing enough? Is there a point where there's nothing more to be done? I mean, we've used as much technology with ultrasound, and we got dogs running around on airports to scare the birds, and we use cannons and everything else. I fly out of Gaithersburg, and they put a fence around that airport, and we still have deer jumping the fence and getting on the runway and things like that. I know that, you know, looking at your article, you know, you talked about a variety of things that, you know, the Forest Service and groups like that are doing. Just give our listeners a little bit of an insight into what you wrote.
Well, you obviously, I'm very glad to hear you're a frequent reader, but you didn't read yesterday's. St. Patrick is the answer. He chased the snakes out of Ireland. Let's get him involved. No, I'm kidding.
Why didn't I think? See, the solution is so simple, Sandy. I didn't even think of it.
Yeah. Turns out, I think I'm Scottish. I'm, according to my DNA, I'm 92% Irish, which is one of the reasons why I'm a good writer, because I make stuff up as it goes. Irish memory, I call it. It's impressive to me the degree to which USDA, the FAA, TRB, the airport research people have done, trying to come up with creative ways, including, you know, doing things that just have to do with the topography to make it difficult for certain breeds to get on field. I think it's just one, it's like most of aviation safety. It's a constant awareness, a constant looking for answers. And we're never going to get to zero. But, you know, the only thing we can do is, A, recognize that we're coexisting with a species that isn't necessarily attuned to the same stimuli as we are, and figure out how best to defend against the problems, to, you know, how you get an airplane and a bird at 40,000 feet to avoid each other. I don't know, maybe we have to put transponders on the birds or something. And then what pull-up might actually be scary at the bird. I don't know. It's something that I repeat in the blog on a fairly regular basis because I think it bears repeating. I'm hardly an expert on wildlife other than my years, also as a native Washingtonian, down in Atoka, Virginia, killing off Marmonta monarchs that threatened Mrs. Kennedy's horse. Honest to God, my father and I were sitting on a hill killing woodchucks, and two Secret Service agents came over the fence behind us on horses, told us to open up the breaches, and then Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis jumped the fence about 150 yards, easy shot for us, right, left or right. And I was 16 years old, and I think my pupil was permanently damaged by the degree to which it was open. But it's, I think it's something that all of us need to be aware of, and I think they have the right people looking at it. I'm impressed with some of the creative solutions, and that's why I sort of documented. I thought they were kind of interesting stuff. And that silly dog, I love that story about it. With the, you know, his owner put the aviator goggles on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That really worked. Birds don't like dogs barking at them. My beetle's outside barking at something right now. I'd like to do a little more talking, if it's okay, about rebuilding the FAA around the world.
Sure.
Is that right?
Yep.
I'm not saying I have any absolute evidence, but I am sufficiently aware of when I was at the FAA, my counterparts around the world, including some of the not so huge and important places, that I think IASA, our International Aviation Safety Audit, assessment audit's a dirty word, is a problem. I mean, in 1990, we had the Avianca crash, and Congress reacted to that. IASA became a responsible requirement, and it's a requirement. It's at least triplicating or quadruplicating, whatever the fourth level is, of ICAO, IASA, IATA, the FAA. And I remember meeting the Director General of Civil Aviation Brazil, former four-star general in the Air Force, probably really didn't care very much about civil aviation, but got a nice office and nice salary. And I can just envision one of the IASA people, who's probably a grade 12 guy who's busting his tush to get up to the next level and make a name, after he or she has done the review of ANAC, turning to this four-star general and saying, listen, kid, you guys aren't good enough. That's obviously not, it's a good example because it wouldn't happen with Brazil. But that's what worries me. The people who are involved in this project are by definition not diplomats and are likely not to deliver these messages with the greatest of diplomacy. Or at the other end of the scale, I was actually consulting for the Israeli government when they had a meeting about one of their BASA agreements. And the general fighter pilot who was my client came after a couple of drinks at the cocktail party and says, Sandy, we're in great shape. They're really ready to move us up another level. And I said, well, that's great. So I spent about 10, 15 minutes talking to some of my old buddies, and they said, we're about ready to pull their BASA. So that's the reverse phenomena. The engineers are not necessarily gifted at diplomatic talk. They were trying to downplay the problems and completely lost it on this guy. I just think this is not a good thing for us to be in. I don't know why we need four of them. I don't know why it's a audit. I know they don't call it that, but I don't understand why it's an audit. What these people need is not somebody to come in and tell them bad, somebody to sit there and help them rebuild to something good. You know, the whole principles of SMS say we shouldn't be doing enforcement, as it were. And that's what it really is. I mean, if you have a Category 2 standard on IASA, it's huge economic impact. And if you follow what happened when President Obama went to India, it's a joke. I mean, it was 100% clear that they were restored to level 1 with five, count them, five conditions subsequent. And none of the five I can ever find were rectified. So I think we ought to get out of that business. And I would say that we ought to get a joint process between all four of the people who are involved in it, hire some people either within the industry or without to go in like it was an SMS audit. And, you know, so you go through one of these things and the guy tells you your relationship between you and your boss is inappropriate because your boss is a political appointee and your boss reports directly to the prime minister. So I go to my boss and say, I don't have to talk to you anymore. Probably not a good idea, even in a more diplomatic or generous way. Just the notion that the FAA tells us that we, a sovereign nation, can no longer have you and me talk or report to you. That's not the way to do it. But what you do is have somebody who's there, who's an independent third person recognized expert, to go to the head of the transportation organization countrywide and say, the global model is that we give some independence. That increases the stature of the person who works for you. It gives you some added freedom of time, and it gives the world your blessing. That's not something the FAA auditors could do or should do. And I think we need to move away. You know, the government, the United States, has something called the TDA, and its job is to promote transportation entities around the world for the United States. Why couldn't they fund this third party effort? I don't know. It's just something I think, like my idea of Underwriters Laboratory, while totally rational, may not be well accepted. I think this has a little bit more acceptability. If nothing else, we free all those people who are doing the IASA stuff, and they can go work as aeronautical engineers, you know, out in Renton or someplace. It's one of the things that living outside the building and having absolute total 100% vision and absolutely zero responsibility for implementing is something I think we need to do to get from here to there. It's just something I think that could help. And, you know, that's what you guys are really about, is improving safety. And we have, what is it, miles to go before I sleep?
There's no shortage of work in this business. No shortage of work.
Yeah, well, that's what I think we need to figure out how to do. And you guys have the audience that maybe somebody will say, have my second cup of coffee. Idiot Murdoch doesn't sound quite as crazy now that I've had some coffee, and maybe we ought to do it. And, you know, if you guys say it makes sense, the number of idiots will decrease.
Well, we certainly need to change what we're doing, because we're not getting the results that we need.
No.
You know, that saying about only a fool does the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And too many of institutions are just doing the same things over and over.
I think it's Einstein's definition of insanity, right?
Yep. That's what it was.
So yep. It must be true.
Yeah, right. Well, it's crazy times. I just, I feel bad for the overall FAA, because they really have taken a beating, and that really not justified.
Yeah, and the Boeing MAX 8 was horrible. And the people who had the fall of the hand grenades weren't the people who made the problem. That's very, very difficult. Dan Elwell was not the guy that allowed the ODA to do what they did. And he, you know, got excoriated more than the average ordinary human being. I don't think that's fair or right or meet or just or whatever that Episcopalian prayer is.
Well, you know, when you get between Congress and a problem, it can be painful, especially if Congress created the problem, because then they're going to want no responsibility for it, and they're going to be looking doubly or triply hard at passing that blame off to some other entity.
I don't think members of Congress are conscious of or aware of the degree to which, when they say jump, the people in the FAA and other places don't just jump, they go nuts. And John, I'm sure you remember well the hearings on the Dallas ISDO and the whistleblowers and all that kind of stuff. However right or wrong it was, what they did by yelling and screaming at those people is the people in the FAA headquarters organization were emasculated. And that's an odd term to use for Peggy Gilligan, but that's what happened. I mean, thereafter, the line people in the FAA said, we don't have to listen to you. Yes, there were things that went wrong there. And yes, they needed to be brought forward and given good publicity. But they're meat cleavers in a surgical world is the way I would think of it. And it's Congressman DeFazio knows the world better than that. And he's just, you know, the only person that was smarter than him was Jim Oberstar. And they both are doing a great job of representing aviation safety. But we got to remember, you're the board of directors of the FAA, whether you like it or not, the Congress and Senate. And the people in the FAA listen, and they somewhat overreact, in fact. And so we need to get to a situation where you have greater comprehension between the two. I mean, I had a very famous congressman from Georgia staffer call me up in the middle of the PATCA strike and say, I want Jones restored to the air traffic control tower in Atlanta. And I said, yes, ma'am, I will issue a press release saying that Congressman Gingrich ordered the FAA to rehire a fired controller. She said, well, that's not exactly what I meant. I said, that's what you did mean. They're not ignorant. They're trying to do their job. First Amendment's a big deal to them. They want to get their constituents well taken care of, and they do. The people up in Albany are still working hard on issues that I really don't think had anything to do with the crash. Shit is too exciting. We need to have less reason for anybody saying anything about aviation being guaranteed to be on the evening news, excluding you, Greg. You could be on all the evening news. We'll designate you.
Thank you. Well, Sandy, I know that we've talked a lot, and again, we always try to bring on folks that have a greater subject matter expertise than John and I, and we always want to try and bring our listeners a different perspective. The FAA, as we've talked about, is currently under constant fire, especially now, and again, a lot of folks, even in our industry, have questioned their competence, their abilities to certify aircraft or oversee aviation and things like that. And while some of the criticism is probably warranted, there's always a backstory. And John and I made this show about backstories and the stories in the shadows, because there's always something else going on that the casual observer or somebody sitting in front of a TV watching a news story about the FAA doesn't really understand the backstory. And you being in the government, John and I, having been in the government, we were exposed. We saw those backstories. We understand what takes place behind the scenes that does influence. And while it doesn't look logical to the observer, we understand why things do happen or don't happen. So we appreciate you coming on the show and bringing some of that perspective. I know that we always try to make our subject matter experts a friend of the show so that we can bring you back whenever we have issues to discuss and that kind of stuff, where we know your subject matter expertise will be very beneficial. And I do want to have you back on the show, hopefully in the near future, because I want to talk about general aviation and general aviation pilots, the compliance action, the philosophy of the FAA, just with the fact that, you know, the FAA has gone through its ups and downs with enforcement actions against pilots, and they went to the kinder, gentler methodology, and then they went back to compliance through enforcement, and now they're back to this compliance action where they try to do counseling. And a lot of that came up with Harrison Ford, since he made the news multiple times with some of his exploits. So we want to get you back on the show and give our audience, who, you know, a lot of them are general aviation pilots and aircraft owners, I know would find a discussion like that beneficial. So plan on being back on the show.
I'd love to. Today's blog is on enforcement and Administrator Dixon saying that zero tolerance is going to be in effect as long as we have masks on board. I think zero tolerance for flight attendant assault should be a permanent rule. I'm sure John will agree with me. It's just ridiculous what people think they can get away with in dealing with flight attendants. And as a former airline employee, I think it's absurd. The notion that it was ever sexual is horrible, but just any kind of that stuff. And sending people to jail, like it or not, are something that eventually will get the sober people to understand. So,
yep. And it is sad because, you know, just looking at it, I fly just about every week. I'm leaving on a trip again today. The lack of respect that, you know, some of these folks have, and especially recently with the abuse, just the abusive behavior by passengers, the defiance of, you know, their personal belief that they don't think they have to wear masks. They have no respect for fellow passengers and of course, the flight crew. And then the flight crews are left to deal with unruly passengers, guys who or gals who have are intoxicated or whatever, just add to it. So, yeah, we can definitely do a whole show just on all of that. And I know that that, too, will be a topic of discussion as passengers return to flying.
And trafficking in the same sort of, that's another one of the things that really doesn't meet what JDA does. But God, that bothers me.
Yeah.
The fact that planes are being used for this is just horrible.
Yep. So, well, again, we appreciate you being on the show today, Sandy.
I can now crank down my chair about 6 inches so that I'm at my normal level. higher air is something that's scary to an old fart like me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks for taking the time to be on the show with us.
Thank you.
Well, John, I think this was another great show. I know that our listeners will find this informative, and we appreciate your feedback as our listeners. John and I have gotten a lot of emails recently. One email in particular that John and I are preparing a show for with regard to some of the comments we made on a previous show about a study that was conducted by Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, a PhD student there. And we've got an email from a listener who basically categorized me and John as just a couple of old white guys who don't know what we're talking about. So we're putting that show together right now to address that particular email, some of the concerns, and we're looking to have the author of that study on our show. So look forward to that. And John, I know that, you know, with our listeners and they send us emails, which we encourage you to do, good, bad, or indifferent. You can always touch base with us at our email at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And of course, John and I try to respond to everything. And then when we find emails like this, of particular interest or whatever, we're going to start putting them, we're going to start talking about them on the show. We're going to try and bring those folks on that can give the perspective to that email and help us address these emails. Because, hey, we all know, John and I are very aware that, yeah, you may not agree with everything we say, and that's fine. That's the whole purpose of this show. We bring experts on, folks that have been in the industry to give a perspective as well. And again, we appreciate just trying to educate. We're going to try and give you all sides. when we dissect things, of course, we always talk with factual information and in a high level of knowledge. We can't always disclose how we know things, but we know things. And so, again, we appreciate our listeners' points of view as well. And so, you know, John and I have these discussions, just like we're going to have a discussion right now from John.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to let our listeners know that on a recent show, we talked to one person who sent us an email. We read the email and thought it was interesting, and we contacted that person and had her on the show. There's another email that had just caught my attention earlier today, and that I'm going to reach out and see if they're willing to come on the show. I think that may be a regular feature, not every show, but a regular feature on the show where we reach out to our listeners that have a different view, a more informed view, something that separates it from us and our opinions, and bring them on the show and talk about it. Because we realize that we always don't have the 100% accurate. We may not know something, and we're willing to listen. I'm willing to change, and we hope all of you likewise willing to listen and willing to change when you find out you're doing something that's not quite right. So with that, Greg, I'll let you start the closing.
Well, thank you, John. I always appreciate when you give me that duty and responsibility. Again, we want to thank you, the listeners. You're the ones that make this show, and your feedback is very valuable to us about the quality of the show and that kind of thing. And again, John and I, because of our travel schedules and responsibilities, we are trying to evolve the show, especially as we've talked about over the past year and getting more into the video part of it. And we're now moving into at least the third quarter of that whole process. So hopefully we'll have it up and running very soon. And then, of course, we always want to thank our listeners who have contributed money. I saw recently that we've had a number of our listeners contribute money to the operation of the show and helping us produce the show. So for those of you that have contributed, thank you very much for your contribution. That means a lot to John and I. Again, we bring this show to you because we have this passion. And while, yes, we are paying for it, and we do appreciate the money that our sponsors provide us and, of course, our donors. Every little bit helps to keep this show going and growing. So that's what we're attempting to do, hopefully, in the very near future. And given the fact that we do have two prominent sponsors, PAMA and Avemco, we really appreciate the fact that they've stepped up to help us over the past year and a half grow this show. And you can always get a hold of Avemco if you have any kind of aircraft insurance needs. They are outstanding to work with. I've always had a great relationship with them because they have been my insurance company for my aircraft. They have been responsive. They're attentive. And I can't say anything about the fact other than the fact that they've always been very receptive to assisting me in my insurance needs. So definitely check them out at avemco.com. You're going to be talking directly to the insurance company, not through a broker. And I think that in and of itself does a lot to foster a good relationship between, of course, the client or customer and the insurance company. So with that, John, I will leave you again with the last words.
Okay. And just to add on, Avemco's phone number is 888-879-0389. So if you need any form of aviation insurance, give them a call. And we're still in the midst of COVID. So please, in your personal life, wear a mask, wash your hands, do everything that's appropriate so you don't catch this terrible disease. And if you're flying, please, 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 do a good pre-flight, which includes planning your trip out. As Greg mentioned in the beginning of the show, you need to have an alternate place to land. You're going to need to know what you're going to do if something unexpected happens on takeoff or landing when you have slow speed and low altitude. Know where you're going to go. And otherwise, please fly safely.
To listen to more episodes of the show, go to FlightSafetyDetectives.com or the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association at PAMA.org and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Catch us next time when John Golia and Greg Fife talk about all things aviation. Thanks for listening.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.